Oh, but it was updated on December 4th, 2023.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is for 2024. All right. So we'll go back to the Bill is Right.
Once. Once.
Who won that argument now?
You did, Bill.
Oh, let me say that again and clearly in the microphone this time.
No.
Bill won the argument. I saw it. Okay.
Welcome to episode 29 of Black, White, and Blue in the South, a podcast discussing Democratic politics with a Southern flair. I'm Bill Kimmler.
I'm Jameel Brooks.
And we're coming to you from Greenwood, South Carolina, a little red county in a very red state. If you like what you hear, please leave a rating and a review, tell your friends about us, follow us on social media, or better yet, send Senator Tim Scott a beginner's book on the female reproductive process.
My God.
You see, he sent out a fundraising email which said the following.
If we don't take back the Senate, Dems will pack the courts, give DC statehood, grant abortions up to 52 weeks, and Republicans will never win again.
Now, let's unpack that a bit. Did you catch anything odd about that statement?
Does he know someone who's carried a baby for 52 weeks?
Help me with the math. How many months is that?
Too many for a human. How long do elephants carry babies? What is he?
Yes, it's out there, all right.
I can't even go with it's a typo.
No. That's intentional.
That's intentional.
That's 52 intentional.
Weeks.
He's saying that Democrats are up for abortion 3 months after birth.
That's what he said.
You watch out. We're coming after your kids.
He said 52 weeks.
Let us know what you think by dropping us a note at blackwhiteblueinthesouth@gmail.com. You know, I give that email out every week, and we have yet to receive a blessed email there.
Maybe it's going too fast.
You can be the first. blackwhiteblueinthesouth@gmail.com. Send us a message and keep our hopes alive that somebody out there is listening. Send us your comments, questions, and topic ideas. You can find us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, Threads, and Mastodon. We share video clips of our episodes and links to news articles that'll make you more informed. Now, that's a lot to process, but fortunately, we have a Linktree page that easily connects you to everything. So look at those show notes where we'll have that and links to all material mentioned in today's episode.
Yeah.
This is part two of our episode with Sevi Alvarez, candidate for South Carolina Senate in District 11. In our last episode, we interviewed him about his candidacy and his activism. This week, we'll hear him partake in some of the news items that we reviewed. Thank you, Sevi, for being a guest on our show.
Yay, Sevi.
But before we get to Sevi, I do want to share some sad news that I learned on the way here to record this podcast. I am heartbroken to share that Simeon Spearman, an extraordinary artist, a loving husband and father, and a generous donor of his talents to the Greenwood County Democratic Party, passed away on March 14th. All of our love goes to his wife, Tawanda, and their family. On a personal note, Simeon was a great booster of mine. He'd always call me Mr. President, and one of his works of art hangs prominently on the wall of my home office. It's a pencil sketch of Al Pacino from Scarface. He's one of my favorite actors, and I absolutely adore it. Rest in power, Simeon. You will live on in our hearts and minds and in your art. There is one clip that I do want to play. This is a fantastic little clip just to get us warmed up for today's episode.
Okay.
There's a guy, his name is Incrediberry. That's his TikTok handle.
Okay.
It sounds like he's from Alabama, and he hypothesizes what it would be like if Jesus were alive today and ran for office. All right. You want to hear what Incrediberry has to say?
Yes.
All right. This is good.
I've said it before and I'll say it again. In many parts of the country, especially in Alabama, where there are 13,000 churches, if the election was between Jesus and Satan ran under the Republican ticket, Jesus would lose in a landslide. And I'm not saying Jesus would run as a Democrat. He could be a member of the Green Party. He could be a Libertarian, independent. As long as Satan had the R beside his name, conservative Christians would overwhelmingly fill in the circle on the ballot beside Beelzebub. And it'd be a hell of a campaign. Literally. They point to Jesus saying, welcome all immigrants, and say, we can't have open borders. They point to him saying, render unto Caesar, and say, Jesus worships the government, would raise taxes. They point to his words of love, tolerance, and not judging, and call it DEI. Mm-hmm. They see him heal the sick for free and say, who's going to pay for that? I paid my medical bills. Why should I have to pay for somebody else's? They will come up to him on the campaign trail and say, hey, are you that fellow that's running against Satan? And Jesus will say, I am he. And they say, oh, we don't do them pronouns around here. They will point to him, feed the masses, and say it's socialism and we should be given handouts, and if you want to eat you should pull yourself up by the bootstraps and not depend on the government. They will say Jesus is against abortion and gays, and Jesus will say, well, I'm Jesus and I've never said a word about either. And then they go, Jesus is gone woke. They'd use this picture and ad saying, this is what they want. Grown men in dresses reading to kids, indoctrinating our precious children with their sick agenda. You can't tell me that wouldn't happen. Conservative Christians would literally put Satan into office over Jesus as long as Satan had an R beside his name. And then without a hint of irony, they say, we got to get Jesus back into people's lives. Because they will hear everything I just said and say, well, we're not actually against any of that. We're just against the government being a part of it. But they want religion in the government because we're a Christian nation. But they don't want to do any of the teachings that the Jesus they worship taught. Mm. Because the only way you can be a conservative Christian is if you vote for the people who do the opposite of what Jesus said to do. How else can you explain the party of Protect the Children proudly wear AR-15 lapel pins when guns are the number one killer of kids, and their other preferred piece of decoration is a cross, which Jesus died on? These are the people who will stand under the cross as Jesus told the thief, amen, I say to you today, you will be with me in paradise, and mutter to themselves, they should have complied. Hallelujah, and roll tide.
Wow, was he wrong?
Nah, I mean, he brought it. It's facts.
Can I vote for that guy?
Yeah, I know, right?
Oh, yeah. He right. He'd get my vote, man. Yeah. He was, you know, I don't know what it would take to come up with that material or be able to say it like that off the top of your head, but that guy was amazing. He was every point was spot on.
Yeah, it was natural.
That was incredible.
Yeah, that needs to go viral.
Maybe I think it has. Is. I don't know. It has, okay. Seve. You're good. I'm sure he appreciates the advice.
Yeah.
Fired up! Ready to go!
There's another topic that we're late on getting back on. You and I attended a major event back in January. This was the First in the Nation dinner in Colombia that featured President Biden speaking.
Yeah.
In fact, Seve, you texted me about coming on our podcast while I was at that dinner.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
That's where I was at the time. So I want to tell this quick story before we get into the event itself. This is truly embarrassing, which means it's going to be great podcast material.
Oh, I remember that. Okay, go.
So on the way to the event, I was listening to a podcast called Bourbon in the Back Room. It is a political podcast in South Carolina featuring former state senators Vincent Shaheen and Joel Lurie.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know those names, but they're big names. They were great. In fact, Vincent Shaheen ran for governor, I think maybe twice. Unsuccessfully. But they have a podcast called Bourbon in the Back Room, and they interview a lot of movers and shakers in the world of South Carolina politics. And they just had done an interview with Representative Spencer Wetmore. And she is a great Democratic representative, engaging interview. I was thoroughly entertained. Anyhow, we get to the event and we're sitting at the table and I saw this lady walk by. I was like, I think that's Spencer Wetmore. And I want to tell her how much I enjoyed hearing her on that podcast. So I walked up to her. And in fact, I wasn't quite sure if it was her, but I checked the photo of her on my phone with who she was, and it was a close enough match. In fact, I even conferred with the chair of the Oconee Dems who was sitting next to me at the table. I said, that's Spencer Wetmore, right? She's like, oh, yeah, that's right. So I walk up and introduce myself, and I said, you're Representative Spencer Wetmore, right? She goes, no. And then she even looked at me like, creep. And I was like, okay. So I just turned around, sat back down, you know, put my head in my hands. And I was like, oh, man, I am thoroughly humiliated. I go, that wasn't her. And
yeah.
This lady continues walking around and she's meeting and greeting. You can tell she is known, right? She is somebody in the room because she was talking with everybody. And then it hit me. It wasn't Representative Spencer Wetmore. It was Representative Beth Bernstein. And I looked, and yep, it was the straight blonde hair, the sharp facial features. And I was like, I just totally made a jerk out of myself by, you know, misidentifying the wrong. Imagine, like, you work with somebody and somebody comes to you and says, oh, are you so-and-so that you work with? You're like, no, that ain't me. What mm-hmm. do you think? We all look alike just because I'm a white woman. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. we all look alike. And so I was like, man, I better go up and apologize. So I get my courage up and I was about to sit up at the table when a guy that I was at the table with sits down next to me mm-hmm. and tells me, oh, that's not a representative at all. That's somebody else who's into fundraising. In fact, it turned out it was somebody named Ashley Floyd, and she's a fundraiser for various candidates. She's kind of works in those circles as a tremendous fundraiser. But I almost went up to her
a second time
and misidentified her in an attempt to apologize. And I swear to you, if I had come this close, I think I would have just left the building and not have seen President Biden speak. So I'm going to play two clips, Jamil. The first one is Representative Jim Clyburn.
Okay.
And Jim Clyburn told an amazing story about student loan debt relief and how it truly affected one of his constituents that wrote him a letter thanking him for all of the administration's efforts on that.
Yeah.
And this gentleman says that I had been paying for 25 years. I had put in $255,000. I'm sorry, $215,000. But I still owed $119,000. This is the letter. And then he said, you also said, Mr. President, that if you had paid for 35 years or for 25 years and you thought you had paid more than you should have, you can get a rebate. And here's what he said. I got my entire $119,000 eliminated, and on October 1st, I receive a check for $56,800. And when you hear these Russian bots, you hear these people using social media who saying that Joe Biden is not kept his promise to students, tell him about this letter. He's kept his promise.
How about that, huh?
Wasn't that
a moment?
I love that.
It also brought me back to something you said very early on in our podcast. You had a whole statement about there's power in the pause, and Representative Clyburn will put pauses after every word.
Do you notice that?
Oh, yeah.
You notice that?
Such power in the way he speaks.
Yep. And he's allowing your brain to slow down to catch it and be ready for that next part.
Yes, mm-hmm. That was amazing. So I thought that was a great...
effective speaker.
A great speech and a great letter. There's one more clip that I want to play. But before we get to this clip, did you have any impressions or memories from that dinner that you want to share?
I just cannot get over listening to President Biden.
Yes.
So here's what people have to know. And I'm glad that I was able to be fortunate enough to be there to see it for myself. You hear and you read so much about his age and his inability to maintain. You have non-clinicians evaluating his cognitive ability. Let me tell you what he was able to do. And this goes to show you that cognitively, he's better than some of the people who are saying he should step down. He was able to do a speech, Sevi, have interruptions, not lose track, crack a joke, not lose track, get mad. And then what really made me say they can all be real quiet, he was able to recount someone else's speech before him, include it in his speech, and keep going. And never once did I see him look down and read anything off of a piece of paper. So if you can manage that many distractions in a high intensity moment, don't tell me that your cognitive ability should be questioned. You're more prepared than some of the same people who are saying we need to have a test on your cognitive abilities.
Amen. Let's listen to Biden speak here and hear exactly what it is you were saying.
Yay.
For all those who have been knocked down, count it out. Left behind. This is your campaign. That same message has defined my presidency.
So I chose that clip for two reasons. Okay. First, you got a sense of the power of Biden's speech, right? So that opening part, you were like, I'm digging, I'm following what you're saying, I'm there. But then you also heard one out of three different protesters that jumped out of their seats. All three were young people. Two were protesting about the war in Palestine, and then one was about environment.
Yeah.
I wanted to get a sense of what that was like, because you can hear even in the headphones, like, where did that voice come from? It felt like it was right behind you.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that lady was behind us, and she just jumped up and started shouting before she got dragged out of there.
But he maintained.
He did. He did.
He did not drop the ball.
He knows what he's doing.
Yeah. Now, what I don't get, and I've seen this even in Republican speeches where, whether it's Trump or Nikki, they get protest or interrupted speech and the whole crowd just starts chanting 4 more years. You know, that I don't get.
Yeah.
Right. That to me, I didn't participate in that because I didn't feel like that's how you drown out a protester. That to me seemed a little odd.
Yeah. I think their approach to that is, we're going to show the one or two protesters that are here that we have his back. We're going to support him. I think it is a distraction to the message.
I really wish he would address that whole issue entirely. He ignored it in the speech.
I think he should have.
But when you hear that protest speak up saying, hey, we do not support the Israeli attacks on the Palestinian civilians, which is happening. There's no denying it.
Yeah.
There's no denying that the Palestinian, Hamas started it by attacking Israeli citizens, right? But now it's gone so far in the other way that there needs to be, in my opinion, a stoppage of all that hostility and let some things settle down. But instead of shouting down the protester, I do think the protest or should have been dragged out because you're interrupting the president. All right.
Yeah.
So you'd lost your right to be in that room. See ya.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then I really think the president should have taken the time to say, listen, I hear that. I hear it all the time. And here's what I believe, and at least address it head on. This ignoring of that issue is not helping him.
I don't think it is. But do you think that he has not heard that before? That protester did not come to him with a question he ain't heard before.
Oh, no. It's happened everywhere he goes.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then why still not address it in any speech or out loud?
I think what's happening is he's addressing, but he ain't addressing it the way we want him to. Like, we want exact words to come from his mouth to call for whatever those actions are. And because we're not hearing it that way, we tend to say we want more. And that's our right. Like, we should be able to say this is what we would want from our president. But her jumping up to say it doesn't mean he hadn't heard it before.
Well, you have a point there that maybe he's not addressing it the way we want him to, but it doesn't mean he's not addressing it. In fact, just yesterday, there was a news bulletin that came out that a U.S. military aircraft airdropped thousands of meals into Gaza as part of an emergency humanitarian aid operation.
Yeah.
And that means he's acting.
He's acting.
He's acting. But it would be nice if he would promote the fact of what he's doing behind the scenes to work things out.
You know, maybe I think that's one of the things that I've heard or read somewhere before and was in a conversation. One of the things about Biden is there's not enough of promoting on what he has done specifically.
Yeah.
So a lot of his support and things that would be what the American people want goes under the radar.
Yeah. You know, on the topic of Israel and Palestine, I think he's doing a lot of work behind the scenes. And I think that airing that out publicly could risk jeopardizing that behind the scenes work and giving us less influence over the Israeli government. That's my guess of why he's not directly addressing it more frequently.
Yeah, I
still think there's ways he could word things that doesn't jeopardize it. You know, to ignore it entirely is also speaking very loudly. And that's a hurt. But he has come out and said that he wants the pain and the suffering to stop. He does support humanitarian efforts.
Yeah.
And this is just probably the first of several acts that we're going to see become publicized where the United States has said we've had enough and are going to intervene on humanitarian purposes. Now it's time for the news.
For up to the minute reports, stay tuned to this station. Now the news.
Governor McMaster's response to the lack of a hate crime law in South Carolina. So this came out, and what it was saying is that the question that has been on everyone's mind is, why is it that South Carolina is one of the last two states that doesn't have a hate crime law? And McMaster's, there's a video. Do we have the clip? There's a video. So listen to the clip, and then we'll come back and we'll give you some more on the article.
South Carolina remains among the very few states that does not have a hate crime law. And it's been a hot topic among lawmakers in recent years. Now, today, that topic sparking conversations at the State House after an event in the Lowcountry. ABC Columbia's Maya Payton reports.
A black mannequin seen hanging from a tree outside a white family's home in Charleston County. It has many members upset and wanting answers. At the State House, the concerns reaching the ears of Governor Henry McMaster. He was asked in light of this if it's time for South Carolina to establish a hate crime law.
Now, sometimes the presence of hatred or dislike or even lunacy is fairly clearly expressed by the actors themselves. But when you create something, you call it a hate crime, it's based on thought that may not be vividly expressed, which then opens the door to investigations and prying into people's personal lives. And it just, I'm concerned it could go way too far.
The governor says he understands the concerns, but believes a hate crime law would be, quote, stepping into dangerous territory. And with it being Black History Month, the governor was asked about the many African Americans who continue to express that more needs to be done.
You see, when these indictments come out, somebody is charged not with one thing, but 40 different things. I mean, there's plenty of room in there without opening the door to determining someone's private thoughts. And I understand the want to do it, but I believe that statements could be made under current law, that is, at the time of sentencing. This could all be handled within the scope of the pre-sentence reports in federal cases and the investigative reports in our state cases. It just in our efforts to make things better, we have to be careful not to make things worse.
I'm Maya Payton reporting, ABC. Columbia News.
What y'all governor just said is that...
Oh, please tell me, because I could not understand that word salad that he threw out there.
In layman's terms, he's saying that if I work to pass this bill, I'm going to piss off a lot of my constituents so that I can protect them and their private thoughts. I'm going to act like it's really not a problem, and I'm going to try to look away from this major issue and give y'all a whole bunch of crap. And hope y'all gonna take it, because what I don't want it, and it was a silent threat, which I felt was disrespectful. He gonna have the nerve to stand on them people TV and say that I don't want to make things a whole lot worse. Sir, you just admitted that South Carolina is worse as it is in regards to a hate crime. So if you're going to speak, we're going to unpack what you said. You just admitted it's an issue. And so you don't piss off your constituents. What you would prefer for us to do is to cover their actions in other forms of laws. So South Carolina want to hide behind the major racism and the hate and allow the federal government to try to overlap and take care of some of these issues. A big problem for me. South Carolina and Wyoming are the only two states who have not passed a hate crime bill. This bill or a version of this bill was presented in 2021. It died because no one touched it. Revision after revision. Those who are opposing this bill are opposing it on the behalf of an attack on the freedom of speech. But if you are opposing this on the behalf of the freedom of speech, if the people who need freedom to speak are dead, who would the freedom of speech be for? It is one particular targeted audience, they think. But this hate crime bill could protect not just Black folks. You got members of the LGBTQ that are being attacked. You have a variety of individuals that this hate crime bill could protect. Now, my issue with the senators, and I'm getting ready to speak particularly to Shane Massey. I think he covers Saluda, Edgefield County, and parts in McCormick County. When asked about passing this hate crime bill, he said, don't hold your breath. I'm not sure if Shane has checked his diversity in his constituents, but to say don't hold your breath lets us know that this is not a priority. My other issue is these members of the Senate sat alongside the former Cindy Clemente Pinckney. They served with this gentleman. They know this individual. They've crossed paths with him. He was murdered.
So what Jamil's referring to is Senator Clementa C. Pinckney, for whom this bill is named. And the same senators who sat alongside them are not pushing this forward. Sevi, as somebody who's looking to sit in the Senate, what's your take on the hate crimes enhancement bill?
I think it's unconscionable that we don't have hate crimes legislation. And I'm confused why the governor is so concerned about protecting the privacy of murderers. That doesn't make sense to me. And I mean, freedom of speech doesn't make sense to me either, because you're not, unless you're trying to say murder is a form of speech that needs to be protected. I don't agree with that.
Can I take a second to talk about what this bill actually does? And then I also want to tie it to the news article we had, because there's actually a disconnect that I want to bring up. The bill is an enhancement bill. So it's basically saying that when you have a violent crime committed and you've already been convicted of that violent crime, now the enhancement part of that means that if the perpetrator has been determined to have committed that with the intent of terrorizing that individual, harming that individual because of religious belief, color, sex, etc., then you get an enhancement to that penalty, which could be no more than $10,000 fine and an additional term of imprisonment of up to 5 years. So basically, you've already been convicted of that crime, and it has to be a violent crime. This isn't a crime of doing damage to property or scaring somebody or something else. It has to be a violent crime. And if it's determined it was done as an act of hate for those reasons, then you can have your penalty enhanced by this section. That's all it is. In my opinion, it's actually small. Like, this is a small law that they're fighting over. And all of the objections that I've heard about it don't even apply. Like, even this news article talked about the hanging of a black person in effigy outside of a black couple's home, right? That itself would not qualify under this hate crime law because a violent act was not committed. But should whoever is found guilty of having done that then go and commit a violent act, beat the people up or, kill them, God forbid, or whatever, then the enhanced penalties could be put on top of that.
I think that what the purpose of mentioning that particular situation that took place in the Lowcountry is to let you know that the hate is there.
Yes.
So don't look away from that part. I want to say here that it took the federal government to protect Senator Clemente Pinckney. The state government could do nothing. That says a lot about who we are truly writing laws to protect. And I wanted to mention that those that are sitting in the Senate, you guys know I always call for somebody to come and get their seat. If they can't remember what they're there to do, somebody needs to make sure that they're on that ballot November the 5th. These individuals had a front row seat to a massacre and chose to look the other way and turn the other cheek, unnecessarily so.
You made a good point about the federal government, which does have national hate crime legislation.
Correct.
And in fact, just this past week, a South Carolina man was found guilty of a hate crime. This was actually groundbreaking. First time this has happened.
Yes.
The South Carolina man killed a transgender woman because of her gender identity. The federal government took on that case and then found a pattern of text messages, et cetera, that showed this person had the intent of killing this individual because she was transgender.
Yeah.
And was just found guilty of that in federal court. South Carolina court would not have even pursued that question. Governor
Correct.
McMaster would have protected this murderer's text messages and done away with it. Now, why have enhanced penalties? People ask, hey, you already have, you're already locked up for murder. You already have a murder charge. You already have this and that. Why do you need even more penalties? Because I'll tell you this, this is how I've explained it to some of my white friends. It says the victim is not only the victim who was beaten up or murdered or et cetera. If it's due to a hate crime, you have now terrorized the entire community. The pool of victims is larger. You have killed somebody because they were black. Now every black person in that community is fearful, right? There was a burning cross and then a murder occurred. Now every person in that community, family, friends, relatives, or other transgender individuals or other people of a sex or religion, they are all now victimized because of that. So intent is indeed important.
Absolutely.
Let me tell you something else, and I might be going a little too far, so just see if y'all want to pull me back.
But all right, when I'm pulling you back.
Oh, when no. I start, Sevi, I go.
Okay.
So I want you to think about some other things. If you understand what a hate crime law could be for, anytime there's a targeted approach on a particular individual, as you mentioned, race, gender, religion, any of those things, right? If we're going hate crime, let me give you some other examples that could potentially fall into being categorized as a hate crime. And I think this might be one of the reasons why the Senate is not jumping on this. It's because it would open the door for other situations to be tried as a hate crime. So I'm going to go. And if I go far, I don't care. I'm going. Y'all can pull me back. I'm looking at the strategic institutionalization of a particular group, black men, in the system. We already know about privatization of prisons and the money that's made off of that. That could be a hate crime.
I'm going to play you back now.
Hold tight. I'm not done. I'm going to give you the whole list and then you can pull back.
Okay.
If we're looking at the maternity mortality rate, being able to help and not helping, that is one thing that can eliminate or decrease a race. I think you should consider, is that something that would make them say, we better not open up this hate crime because somebody might be able to work the writing within a crime or work the writing within a potential complaint that would say this is a hate crime. The infant mortality rate, looking to save only one group of individuals versus the other. Is that a hate crime? Is that being done directly? Is there malice? Is there intent there? Ostracization of the LGBTQ or, like in this recent case, killing of someone who is transgender. Those are things that I'm wondering if they are thinking in the back of their minds, let's not push this hate crime bill through, because if we do, there is a potential that someone else will come up and say that here are some other things that could potentially be supported by the hate crime bill.
So they're now afraid of a slippery slope.
Correct.
So while this law is written specifically for violent crimes,
correct.
Hey, if we open that door up, then who's to say that Representative Jameel Brooks doesn't introduce legislation to now expand the definition of hate crime,
yes,
to include those other things?
Yes.
That makes sense. Interestingly enough, I'll let you know where this sits in the legislation. Did you know that this law, H 3014, has actually passed, mm-hmm, the State House? It has been introduced and passed out of committee in the Senate, but like previous times, it's waiting for general vote in the Senate, where it is, like you said, likely to die, because Senator Shane Massey won't introduce it to the floor for a vote.
He said, don't hold your breath. I didn't say it. He said it.
That's right. I want to share one thing maybe to conclude this topic.
Okay.
I play in the world of TikTok. One of my first TikTok videos ever was on this topic. And it had to do with enhanced penalties. And one of the common arguments made against a hate crimes law is what I said. We already have laws in the books. Why do we need enhanced penalties?
Yeah.
So take a look at this video I made about enhanced penalties.
Enhanced penalties for fentanyl trafficking.
Yes!
Enhanced penalties for parole violations.
Yes!
Enhanced penalties for illegal guns.
Yes!
Enhanced penalties for hate crimes.
No, God! No, God, please, no! No!
Good job, B.
Not bad, huh?
Yes.
That's exactly how South Carolina House Republicans think.
Yeah.
It's blatantly silly and almost obvious in terms of their intent.
I agree.
Well said. Thank you, Michael Scott.
Yeah.
The South Carolina Justice Act had a little bit of rallying at the State House last week. And Jameel actually introduced this topic to me, and I thought, oh, we've already talking about liquor liability laws for like six episodes now, and I'm starting to wonder if you have a problem here. Maybe maybe you own a bar, maybe you invested in a restaurant and you need to get this through. But to be fair, when I actually read this article from Soda City BizWire, it actually opened my eyes, because
okay,
it wasn't just about bars and restaurants, but it was about businesses as a whole.
Yes.
So this was absolutely enlightening. Would you mind maybe explaining in your own words what's going on with South Carolina?
Here we go with the burden of proof. Who's responsible and who's going to carry that weight? And so what Bill is referencing is back in some of our episodes, we talked about if a person goes to a bar and consumes too much alcohol and leaves and has an accident, the bar, even if you've been to two to three, four bars, those owners are responsible. So who should be the one that carries that burden? And insurance premiums are extremely high. So this has been a hot topic. But this particular article looks at the burden that different businesses have to bear in
and
terms of liability.
Not just bars, not just restaurants.
No.
We're talking lumbers. We're talking,
yes,
supply chain, transportation companies.
Yeah.
It's all businesses. So apparently,
yeah,
one of the core tenets of South Carolina law is that if multiple parties have some sort of liability in causing an accident or some sort of injury, right?
Mm-hmm.
The injured party can go after any of them for the full amount of injury.
Yeah.
Wow.
Right. So the extreme example that the restaurant industry gives is, hey, somebody had a cocktail that you normally drink, a mimosa.
Mimosa.
So let's say you had a mimosa in the morning and then you went to another bar later that evening and took 10 shots of whiskey.
Yeah.
And you drove and were drunk and you killed somebody. That family can come after the mimosa restaurant for the full, you know, $10 million judgment because they were part of the chain of events that led to that fatality.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Believe it or not. And it's not just restaurants, but as you were saying, it's all businesses that anybody who has any hint of liability along the way could be sued for the full amount of injury.
Yes.
And that has caused stress with businesses, caused stress with the insurance industry, stress all the way around. And so businesses were rallying against this.
Mm-hmm.
What brought this to your attention?
Just the fact that it just reminds me of, there's really no correlation here, but it reminds me of how the burden of proof is always on someone other than the way the laws are written. So it always goes back, how is it that we can say business number one is responsible and should pay for everything that business number two, three, and four has done? I don't think that that's right. And I think that that is one of the things that drives up these insurance premiums, and it forces small business owners out of business.
From the business owner point of view, they see that if somebody gets injured and there's multiple pieces along that chain, they go after whoever they perceive as having the deepest pockets.
Correct.
Even if their percentage of liability is small, they'll put the full suit on them because they think they can get the most money out of it. And it's an abuse of the justice system.
It is.
Mm-hmm. There is a law, S-533, called the SC Justice Act. And what it attempts to do is just overhaul this core judicial process by saying that juries or whomever should determine the percentage of fault, if any, and the amount of recoverable damages by applying comparative negligence rules and pay out accordingly.
Mm-hmm.
So even if they bring a lawsuit against one, you know, the mimosa restaurant, the law involved says, yeah, but if there were other things along the way, you have to look at it in its totality and apply percentages. And maybe the mimosa restaurant was 1% responsible for what occurred.
Yeah, because in everything else, we look at contributing factors.
Yes.
So what role did your organization play? And if it didn't play 50% into it, then you shouldn't. And this, the other case that this reminds me of is the husband and wife. And there was a drunk young lady who was driving the golf cart and killed the wife.
Yes.
And I think now the wife's mother is suing as well as someone else is suing. And those businesses that participated or sold to this young lady are all on the line for different chunks of money. And then I think she came up and they're still saying no bond for her. But this is just another example of how we just keep passing that down.
Sevi, have you heard anything about these liquor liability issues? Has that come up in your area?
Yeah, actually, I've heard a little bit about it. But I actually have a question about what you said. The law that you just mentioned, is that something that's already on the books? Or
that's something that's being proposed now.
Okay, so that's a bill. Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is an issue that I feel like is maybe bipartisan in our state. You know, I've heard Republicans speaking out against it, too. I feel like it's something that should be able to get fixed pretty easily, and I don't understand why it hasn't yet.
Well, we can tell you why. What occupation do most of our legislators have?
They're lawyers.
Lawyer.
Right. And how do a lot of them make their money?
Yeah. All right. Yeah.
So this is actually kind of tilting the balance towards the businesses. Now, I like to be informed on all sides of an issue, right? So this, I don't have a small business. And by the way, I think small business owners are some of the bravest individuals out there.
Yeah.
So I wanted to see, what is the opposition to this law? Why is this not just immediately gone through? Well, there was an article written by Yarborough Applegate. You know what that is?
No.
What does it sound like? Yarborough Applegate.
Really sounds like someone who owns horses.
Maybe. It's a law firm.
Okay.
they may own a couple of horses.
They may.
They brought to my attention an article called Victims Beware, A Closer Look at the SC Justice Act. And it was written by Perry M. Buckner IV. Now, I'm a fourth also. So I automatically like this guy. We're like brothers and fourthums. All right, so we're good. Anyhow, Perry writes that S-533 attempts to completely overhaul the system, and it would permit juries to formally assign fault to those who aren't even technically part of the trial taking place before them.
Mm-hmm.
So his first objection is that, you know, I tried to sue Mimosa Restaurant, and now the jury is being told they have to look at all the other restaurants they visit, but they weren't suing any of the other restaurants. Maybe they don't have insurance. Maybe they don't have money. Who knows why they're not being sued?
Mm-hmm.
But now they are going to be forced to look at the whole day's events and assign it. And they feel like that works against the victim. Mm. All right. So that's the opinion they have. They said it's going to turn South Carolina civil trials into a three-ring circus because now you are forced to, you are compelled to bring in all these businesses that weren't even part of the lawsuit that was filed. Maybe that's a bad thing. Maybe it's a good thing. Who knows?
Okay.
The second issue had to do with there is a common practice in the legal system that allows you to collect all the monetary damages from one individual. That is actually a common practice. And his argument is, hey, this is a common practice. Why are we breaking from common practice? This is how it is all over the place. Mm-hmm. To me, that's a very weak argument. That's like saying, well, that's how we always do it, means right. we yeah. should continue doing it. Yeah. He doesn't give a reason why it's a good thing. He just says it's just done that way. This is how he concludes his article. He says, ignoring the stark reality, the SC Justice Act seeks to disincentivize the safe, prudent sale and distribution of alcohol in the state and effectively immunize bars and restaurants from liability in alcohol-related fatalities and injuries. So I read that and I go, well, there's a lot of flowery language in there.
Yeah.
You know, effectively immunize bars, disincentivize safe and prudent sale and distribution of alcohol. I don't see where assigning the mimosa bar, you know, 5% liability is doing any of that. Mm-hmm. It's really putting the blame where it belongs. And that's how you incentivize people to stay and remain safe.
Yeah. Yeah.
I agree
with that.
I'm curious with how other states handle this. Like, is this a problem only in South Carolina or is it nationwide, this liability issue?
That's a good question. I don't know how it is in other states.
Yeah, I don't either. I was just reading this thing. It says the South Carolina Justice Act bill would correct wording in the current law that presently allows for the parties to be held totally liable for damages when they have only a small percentage. I think that totally allows and small percentage are keywords that will be.
So the opposing point is, hey, now victims are going to get less out of their injuries and they're not going to get the full.
But shouldn't there be a cap?
I don't even want to talk caps because I don't know. I've never been in an injury where I've lost my legs from a drunk driver. I don't know what money I would put on that, right? Yeah. But I think the problem is that, yeah, victims should be entitled to compensation.
From the right people.
From the right people. That's exactly it.
That's it. From the right people.
That's exactly it. And we're sorry if that later bar that had no insurance and had no money, that served the 10 whiskey shots that the driver took, had nothing.
Yeah.
That's not the fault of the mimosa bar earlier in the day.
Well, South Carolina doesn't have a problem with alcohol anyway. Didn't we just approve for alcohol to be sold on Sundays?
Yes.
Okay, we good with it. South Carolina say they fine with it.
I have one surprise news item that we're going to wrap up with. Sevi, we like to try to end things on a positive note.
Great.
So I'm going to show this very short clip of a preacher, and we're going to go out on a good note. You ready?
Yay.
Let's do it.
So in the last few days, you might have seen this clip floating around of this pastor down in Union County. Take a look.
You find more women going those places with shorts than you will women with pants and dresses put together. And you know, I used to say this. You know, I haven't said this in a long time. You ready? I said, if you dress like that and you get raped and I'm on the jury, he's going to go free. Now, you don't like, do you? I'm right, though. I can't help you like it. I'm right. Because, you know, a man's a man.
Wow! Now, this dude talking about the circumstances under which he thinks it's acceptable for women to be raped is a pastor at Bible Baptist Tabernacle Church down in Monroe. That is not a small church, by the way. Now, that's horrifying enough, but there's more. That dude operates a school for children, and that school got almost $1 million of your taxpayer money last year. The Tabernacle Christian School is a private Christian academy attached to this church, and state data shows that they got $920,000 in private school vouchers funded by your tax dollars last year. And believe it or not, this school is one of the higher quality ones that those vouchers are going to fund. The whole private school voucher system itself is riven with fraud and graft, not because of any oversight, but because that's how the program itself was designed. It's been designed to fund men and churches like that. Vouchers are a great way to take your tax money and give it to churches where women can't wear shorts.
And that was from a TikTok accounter named Carolina Forward. And I think we can end on that positive note, right?
I knew when you said positive note, you were up to something.
Yeah, you tricked me. I feel deceived.
Yeah.
I also felt, you know, that his video went in a direction I didn't expect it. I mean, first of all, just saying that it's okay to rape women because they were wearing shorts. That is so abhorrent. You don't even need to go into that.
Yeah, talk about saying the quiet part out loud.
When he spent more than half that video tying it to school vouchers and funding these academies. You have no control or say over what indoctrination they put upon the children. That's what burns me. And it really should be an eye opener as South Carolina is heading in that same direction. And that's a wrap on this episode of Black, White, and Blue in the South. We hope you enjoyed what you heard. You can hear Jamel enjoyed it.
Godly.
Please take a quick minute and leave us a rating using your favorite podcast app and a review of what you heard today. If you do, it'll keep creepy pastors like that guy away from women who wear shorts. If you are a blue dot in a red sea, keep the faith. Keep up the hard work. Change only happens over many years of work and dedication. So let's get to work and be dedicated to ensuring democracy stays alive and well in our country.
Oh, Lord. The end.
The preceding podcast is a product of Big Media and copyright 2024, all rights reserved.